Diverse authorities have speculated. Why is it that the common mass of people so adore the rotten, the awful, the trite? In a remote laboratory, two genuine warlocks, Ben R. Williams and Greg Morrison, will look popular taste dead in the eye and hold a scalpel to its bloated gullet. They will read America's most popular books. They will ridicule the New York Times bestseller list. They will destroy their reputations and follow a terrible book even into a rotting grave. This, good people, is cannon fodder.
I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer. I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ben R. Williams.
And I'm Greg Morrison.
And welcome to episode 8 of Cannon Fodder. Tonight we will be discussing The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks.
Chosen by Ben. Let it be noted.
That's a fact. But first, Greg, what have you been reading lately?
Well, I've been reading actually not as much prose as I usually do. I've been reading a lot of longer poems. Been reading The Contos, Ezra Pound's prolonged, lifelong work. I read Patterson, William Carlos Williams' mm-hmm. epic about New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I've been reading The Prelude, and I read a pretty cool book called Beware of Pity by Stefan Zweig about the perils of being nice to handicapped people. That's a comedic exaggeration, but it is about the various discriminations of pity and you know, how pity can be quite destructive and cruel. I've also been reading the writings of John Adams from around the time of the revolutions, like letters, correspondence, political pamphlets, and a kind of unusual book. It took me forever to find called Love by Stendhal. And it was his first, like, original work, I guess. And in it, he purports to analyze in a cold but sympathetic manner the different kinds of love and what exactly happens when you fall in love with someone. Like, why it is that you can't stop thinking about them, like, all that kind of stuff. So, it took forever to find it, and I really, really love Stendhal. So, what about you? What have you been reading?
I've been reading some of the Foxfire books. I've been reading about the moonshining.
Mm-hmm.
Always fun. Coming from our neck of the woods.
Yeah.
You know, always a popular topic. Also, been reading a strange book recently. Kwaidan, I believe it's called. The collection of Japanese folk tales and ghost stories.
Mm-hmm.
I will say I'm not... I'm not one of these people who has this all-consuming passion for Japanese culture. You know, I don't have a giant manga collection or anything at home, but I always find, you know, the folk tales from different countries interesting.
And, mm-hmm.
It's some pretty interesting stuff. They all have that quality that you see in a lot of early ghost stories of where you can see the ending coming from a mile away. Like, and it turned out that spooky figure who no one else saw but one guy was actually a ghost, you know. But they're still pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, one of the most frightening movies I've ever seen, ever, was a black and white Japanese movie, I think from the 50s, based on one of the stories, I think, from Kwaidan. I can't remember what it was called. I think it started with an O, but maybe it's just called Kwaidan. But basically about this man who marries this woman, and he's attacked over and over again by this old hag who, like, periodically haunts a swamp. And of course my parents saw fit to show this to me as some sort of aesthetic education. You're like, oh, well, cinematography's great. All I can think is evil hag swamp monster. No.
Especially rough since at the time you're living in that swamp.
Well,
yeah.
Evil
hag.
Yeah. Yeah. Evil hag lane was tough livings back then, but
I still say she was just misunderstood. But, you know, I'm tender-hearted like that. Well, Greg, what were your expectations going into The Notebook?
Well, you know, all that I knew about The Notebook was that it was a Ryan Gosling vehicle. Mm-hmm. And all I know about Ryan Gosling is that he was in the smash sensation Drive.
Yep.
And so my expectation was that he would be rescuing this woman from the clutches of Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
And that he'd be driving a lot and listening to cool music, and I would fucking love it. Which is pretty much what happened when I watched Drive.
Yeah.
So your
expectations largely met.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was like the print version of Drive.
Not to be confused with the print version of Drive.
Yes. The original novel. No, it was nothing like that. But yeah, we'll get to that. What about you? Did you have any like knowledge or things going in?
The only thing I knew about it, my first exposure to this book, was I remember like when I was in college. This would have been, you know, 2003 through 2007, the early days of the Facebook.
Yeah.
Back when it was called the Facebook.
Right.
And I remember I would sometimes look at the reading lists of some of my college acquaintances.
Right.
You select your favorite books. And there was a disturbing trend where a lot of guys would list, you know, favorite book as Sports Illustrated, I guess.
Yeah.
And but every girl had The Notebook listed. I'm guessing this was because it was around the time the film version came out, but I don't particularly know. I haven't done much research. So that was about all I knew about it, was that a lot of college girls seemed to dig it. I know that, you know, I had heard some running joke that every Nicholas Sparks book is about two white people who fall in love and then tragedy occurs. So I went in expecting that. And that expectation certainly met. I guess go ahead and, since I chose this book, give you folks a brief summary of what exactly it's about. So it takes place in, it is largely set in, I guess, 1946, I think.
Right.
And then about a quarter of it is set in present day, which this was published in 1996, so present day 1996.
Yeah.
The post-war parts follow a young man named Noah, who 14 years earlier had fallen in love with a girl named Allie, but their love was not to be, because she was from a different class, and he was a little bit lower class, and her parents intervened and kept them apart.
Right.
And 14 years pass, and she's engaged to this guy, Lon Chaney Jr. It's quite popular at the time. It's not actually Lon Chaney Jr.
No.
That would have been much
really
cooler.
Cool.
So she's engaged to this attorney named Lon, and she ends up finding Noah again because she's still secretly in love with him, and they have a torrid affair. And we'll leave it at that for now. We'll get to the modern part later in the podcast, I suppose.
Okay.
So, what were some of your immediate thoughts going in as the book fired up, Greg? As it ground into action?
As it grunted to a start?
Yeah.
I mean, it was pretty transparent what the setup was going to be, and it's obvious what The Notebook contains and that kind of thing. I will say that, you know, if we're going to go straight towards what the author seems to think is the meat of the book, which is the contents of The Notebook. So basically, like, in the book, the frame story is in the present day in a nursing home, and The Notebook is the middle part, and we're actually reading that. And it's all narrated in the third person. And so that's, you know, the story of their timeless love and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, in the abstract, a guy past the young sowing of his oats kind of era, who lives out in the wilderness, plays guitar by himself, reads a lot of poetry. You'd think I have a lot in common with this guy, because that's basically me.
You know.
But, I didn't like him at all. I didn't really have anything in common with him. And that was the main thing that kind of bummed me about this book, is that it is really, really bland. It is painfully bland.
Yes.
It is easily the most boring book we have read, well, I have read, for the mm-hmm. podcast.
I would agree with that.
It's just really, really dull. You know, recently I've been reading about, like, Ford Maddox Ford, which brings to mind one of my favorite books, The Good Soldier. And one of the remarkable things about The Good Soldier is that literally in almost every sentence, there is some sort of spark of unfamiliarity. There's some sort of node of strangeness that attracts your eye and makes you think of a new connection or a new resonance. And in this book, it was just sort of a sea of platitudes. And not even platitudes. Platitudes are too lively. Mm-hmm. They're too familiar. It was just sort of drifting from one on-the-nose conclusion to another, and we are in love, aren't we? But yeah.
That was one thing I was thinking about earlier today, was a running theme with the books we are reading is a lack of anything specific.
Yes.
They're just incredibly vague.
Yes.
For example, I knew the book was set in New Bern, North Carolina.
Right.
I don't know where New Bern, North Carolina is. I assumed it was, you know, in the center of North Carolina or somewhere thereabouts.
The mountains.
The mountains. I don't know. I'm an English major, not geography. Jesus. So then at one point, about, you know, close to halfway through the book, when Allie and Noah are hanging out, he's like, oh, yeah, would you like me to make you dinner? Yeah, oh, that would be great. And he goes out to the dock to pull up a bucket of crabs.
Yeah.
So, oh, well, I guess we're on the coast. And I've been paying pretty close attention to the book, and that was the first time I knew that there had been any indication that this book was on the coast.
Yeah.
I'll give you another example of the vagueness and the on-the-nose quality of this. And this was one of two quotes that just leapt out at me. So Noah has this relationship with a waitress after his heart is broken by Allie.
Yeah.
And they're 14 years apart. And they're together for a couple of years, and the waitress ends up leaving him. This is the quote. She had known they wouldn't be together forever. Toward the end of their relationship, she told him once, "I wish I could give you what you're looking for, but I don't know what it is. There's a part of you that you keep closed off from everyone, including me. It's as if I'm not the one you're really with. Your mind is on someone else." "It's almost as if there's a girl named Allie that you loved once and has broken your heart."
Yeah.
"But I am not her."
Yeah.
"That is what it seems like." You know, it's so... There's no subtlety. There's no grace to it. You know, it's the polar opposite of the Hemingway thing, where, you know, the iceberg theory. You see 10% of the story, but because of the way it's written, you can glean the rest. You know, here it's, you're not looking at an iceberg, you're looking at a rock, or a landberg of some sort.
A sadly melting bag of ice. Well, speaking of sad refuse from parties, you know, so one of the quotes that I pulled of an example of the sort of shitty vagueness of the book was actually from the old man portion.
Mm.
So he says, "My days are spent like an old party balloon, listless, spongy, and growing softer over time." Now, actually, I read that with kind of an unfair inflection. That's too effective. but... You know, listless, spongy, and growing softer over time. I don't know in what sense a party balloon is listless. Mm. Moreover, they're not particularly spongy. They grow perhaps less firm, but not softer over time. And also, the question this sort of begs is, are his days growing listless and spongy? Or is he growing spongy? Just like that sort of vagueness of... It's the thing that... I don't like, actually, about a lot of T.S. Eliot. Mm. Which I think Eliot at his best is making fun of people that write like that. Mm-hmm. But at times it's too tempting to write like that, which is basically suggestiveness. And the easiest way to be suggestive is sad. Sad and grotesque. Mm-hmm. And so you can sound really profound without being profound. And That basically sums up old Noah. All sound and fury.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely a quality to this of, it's like a young adult novel.
Yeah.
Where it feels like you can't trust the audience to know what you're driving at, going to have to tell them over and over again.
Yeah.
There is never a single moment of mystery. And even the, well, we had an interesting conversation earlier today because I just finished the book today. And I was talking to Greg about the framework.
Right.
And I said that, well, my opinion is changing after reading the last half of the framework. But when I read the opening framework, the first-person old man narration, I said, like, yeah, that seemed a bit better written than the rest of it, the bulk of the novel. And Greg said, "Well, you know, you might see that character again." Well, yeah, it's got to be Noah. I mean, there's no way it could be anyone but Noah.
Yeah.
But it's set up as though you're supposed to be surprised at the end.
Yeah,
and like in the very end, when you know the nursing home sequence, like the information is meted out very slowly.
Right.
It's like, come on, Nicholas Sparks, come on, man. I know everything. You don't, yeah. You can just say it. Don't be coy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's, you know, and here's actually where a formalistic criticism of the book might leech over into a thematic talk about the book. So, I remember I was reading Shlovsky's Theory of Prose not too long ago, and he made the point that, you know, a lot of times why characters get into trouble or something like that, it doesn't necessarily have to do with a grand design. It has to do with the fact that the only way you can write a story is by frustrating your characters. So, like, you know, the famous comment about, you know, various characters in history, like Don Quixote. You know, like, well, how'd you write Don Quixote? Well, I set him loose in the world, and I thought about what would happen to him. Which is, it's actually about somebody else, but I can't remember who it's about. But the idea is that when you write a love story, you can't write a love story in which everybody's satisfied. You have to, because of the fact that you're writing a story. You need stuff to talk about, and the only things to talk about are frustrations. Mm-hmm. And so you have to sort of talk about a struggle where one person's not at the same point in their love, or, you know, there's a barrier that keeps them apart. Barriers that keep them apart are always good. You know, she's promised to somebody else, that kind of thing. And that kind of leads into a talk about what Nicholas Sparks understands by the word love, which is, basically syrupy, is a short version of that. One of Noah's kindly ethnic mentors, Gus, the old black man, who's very wise, but in an earthy way,
yeah,
which, you know, you wouldn't expect from convention or anything.
No.
Noah's sitting around kind of unreflectively musing on Allie to Gus, and Gus says, "This girl you've been telling me about was your first love, and no matter what you do, she'll stay with you forever." The reason I read it that way, folks, is because despite Nicholas Sparks' claim to be a regional author, he has no ear for dialect or tone or rhythm or anything. But there's this fantasy in the novel, you know, that first love is the only true love, because Allie has never had sex with anyone but Noah. Noah, of course, Ben just, you know, can't keep him out of the women.
Well, he was in the war, you know. I mean, yeah. What else are you gonna do?
He dated a waitress for 2 years. Mm-hmm. He had all these flings everywhere. But the compelling thing for Allie is that she refuses to have sex with her fiancé, no matter how many times he tries to guilt her into it, and no matter how many times his pudgy face tries to, please? But there's this whole thing of like, well, that's, you know, the only person you'll love is the first person you loved, and there ain't no getting around that. And I think that's a very dangerous way of thinking, and, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote a pretty good book about that illusion.
For a variety of reasons, I think many of us can hope that's not the case.
Yeah, really? In God's name.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, going back to Gus for a minute, the inclusion of Gus seemed like a fine indicator that this was written in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
Because, man, there was a weird string of books and films in that time period with the magical old black man.
Right.
Who just, he's very selfless, but he comes into your life and gives you little white fella wisdom. And also, he doesn't use G's on the end of his verbs, and just a little apostrophe, so you know that he's down to earth.
He's too busy with wisdom.
Yeah.
You don't have time for the ending's words, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And he never appears again.
So no.
I thought he would come back, or at least be mentioned again. He just, like, Noah drives by his house once, doesn't see him, like, well, to hell with him. Yeah. On with the rest of the novel. And there's also the other kindly ethnic mentor.
Yeah.
Is, what was his name?
Morris Goldman.
Morris Goldman. who is a Pacific Islander, if I'm not mistaken.
Jew Master Synagogue. surprisingly, in a book that defies expectations mm-hmm. and always keeps you guessing, mm-hmm. a man named Morris Goldman is almost defiantly Jewish.
Yeah.
Is a extremely wealthy war profiteer. he buys scrap metal, like, by the thousands of pounds. Well, I guess an easier way to say that would be tons. In anticipation of the Second World War, and seems to positively root for the world war to break out, because he'll make lots of money. It's like, you know, couldn't you have come up with something? Anything?
Well, just glad he changed his name back from Shylock Nickelgreed. Yeah. Well, and the only quotes, I think, that actually appear from Morris Goldman is there are two times when he's quoted as saying, like, "Well, Noah, you know, the only thing wrong with you is you're not Jewish."
Yeah.
He says it with perhaps a bit more grace than that, but that's pretty much
not really. It's well, like, you know, yeah, I mean, if you were a Jew, I'd give you my daughter. which I guess is supposed to be, like, you know, Nicholas Sparks' fine-tuned observation of religious prejudice, but never really goes that far. And yeah, Morris Goldman, upon his death, leaves Noah a fabulous fortune of $70,000 at the end of the war, which is just unfathomable wealth for an unattached young man.
Yeah, when that was something that surprised me as well, because he uses the money to buy this old plantation house, I guess.
Yeah.
And just take some time off work, but he talks about, oh, well, I gotta be getting back to work soon. Why? Why would you? I remember, you know, apparently, like, in the 50s, my grandfather had a chance to buy beachfront property in Nag's Head for, like, $5,000. And he turned it down because it was too expensive.
That was for Nag's Head. The entire extent.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, $70,000, I mean, even right now, to me, like, $70,000 is a lot of fucking money. I mean,
yeah,
that's almost 3 years of teaching income for me. Mm-hmm. but nonetheless, like, I mean, it would have been a whole lot of money for a young single guy who has no obligations, no nothing. Mm-hmm. And that he doesn't think to do anything constructive with it. I mean, besides fixing up the house, which is cool. It's very strange. And it, I think, tends to give the lie to this idea that we're supposed to have of Noah, that he is, like, rounded and complex. Hmm. When in fact, he's more or less a figment or fantasy that the author projects about himself, seemingly. Hmm. He seems like some sort of nature boy, noble savage kind of thing. You know, like I said, he lives in the woods, and he caresses his three-legged dog, and it's not a euphemism, by the way. That's actually his pet. You know, he plays guitar, and he reads poetry to himself, and he works on a house all day, and all right, cool.
Down in Torture Town, that's where he will be found.
Well, the other thing about Noah, just, you know, characterization, is that, you know, Noah is described as being, like, athletic, basically in spite of himself. You know, he was really, really great at football and every other sport that's ever played. But, you know, he didn't really care about it. And because he's out in the sun all day working, you know, he's real tan. He's got those rippling man muscles. And
lovingly described by Nicholas Clark. It's not,
he doesn't really care about money. You know what? I mean, he is the guardian angel of romance novel heroes. I mean, he is the epitome, the Jungian archetype.
Yeah, and that's one of I think the frustrating things, not only with this book but with a lot of romantic novels, is that I think the illusion of uncertainty is appealing. Actual uncertainty is not.
Right.
I think one of the things that might draw people to this book is that there seems to be, you know, this question, at least in the author's mind, of, you know, ooh, which one is she going to go for?
Right.
The handsome romantic novel hero, or the attorney that she ought to marry but doesn't really like all that much?
Right.
And there's no question. There's never any question in the reader's mind. And there shouldn't be any question in Allie's mind is totally artificial.
Yeah.
No one in their right mind would think, you know, well, I guess the only answer is just to be deeply unhappy for the rest of my life. You know, for propriety.
Impress my mom.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's given me her consent to do this in a roundabout way, on a side note. Which really surprised me and just cranked even more tension out of this thing when her mom, who's been keeping Noah and Allie apart for 14 years, like hiding all the letters that he sent her, she just shows up at his house and basically says, well, you know, follow your heart. And here are all those letters. Yeah. And, you know, I trust you to make the right decision. And, you know, off I go.
Hey, kiddo, whatever turns you on, yeah. You know.
Thankfully, I suffered a blow to the head on the way over here.
That was very strange. I mean, you know, here this guy is. He writes her monthly for years. Mm-hmm. Does he write her in the war? I can't remember.
I think he does.
Yeah. I mean, just the idea of somebody who's like, oh, I'll put these letters away for year after year after year, who just suddenly one day, well, I thought better of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing, you know, for a long time I was thinking, like, well, there's no way that that this is a real person, and that, you know, he would have any particularly compelling techniques that would woo a woman. But there was one thing that he did, Ben, that I'm gonna take to heart. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not often that you read a book that actually teaches you something about how to live. And you know, when Allie and Noah are embracing again for the first time, after 14 long years, and their bodies are quivering with anticipation and crystalline sweat, as Nicholas Sparks describes it.
Sounds like a very painful medical condition.
Drips from her round breasts. There's only one thing that Noah can do to really get her engine going. He rubs his chest against her over and over again. There's this line... I mean, he expends probably half a paragraph on describing how Noah lowers his body down onto Allie and keep, like, this is just like, you know, for like they're kissing, they're touching each other, and all that he does is just sort of Brillo pad his chest up and down her body. Like, oh man. Fred Garvin school of seduction.
Yeah. All I could think of was this sad old cat that my mom used to have that lived in the basement, and like he was a rescue cat and he had no teeth. He'd been out on the street and didn't really know how to love on people, so he'd just growl at you and headbutt you over and over again. That's Noah. Hey, he's, you know, he's been alone for 14 years. So these things happen, I suppose. Forget the mechanics of those things.
Yeah. How did these things work? Yeah.
Well, going back to the war thing, in another issue I had with this book, in the lack of specificity, there's really nothing in this book, in the, you know, immediate post-war parts, that says, oh yeah, that's 1946, all right.
No.
That's 46 if I ever seen it. And there's a very lazy degree, like things that easily could have been added.
Yeah.
And I always bring up stuff like this because I'm a car nerd.
Hmm.
But for example, Allie has a car that she obtains that she drives to Noah's plantation. It's just, you know, well, the car rolled up. And it's only referred to as a car.
Right.
So, you know, that would be the easiest thing in the world to just say, oh, the battered old 40 Ford. You know, just something like that.
Right.
And it would be just the tiniest little touch hold. And, oh, yeah, that's right. You know, it's, I mean, it could take place at any time. Which does not make it timeless.
No. The lack of specificity, in fact, makes it all the less timeless.
Yeah.
There is no sense whatsoever of the horrible shock of the war. I mean, the extent of Noah's experience in the war is summed up as he saw a lot of people die. One time in a trench in France, he thought he saw Allie over him.
Yeah.
So basically, it all comes back to Allie.
Yeah.
3 years trudging through the deserts of North Africa and the horrible, murderous forests of France and apparently Italy. You know, all of it boils down to, well, you know, this chick I made out with one time 10 years ago. I mean, you know, both my grandfathers were in World War II. Your grandfathers were in World War II.
Yeah.
I mean, both my grandfathers were married, but I mean, they also had some pretty vivid memories of being at war.
Yeah.
And it kind of changed them a bit.
Tends to stick to your ribs, that war.
And it was mainly just for picturesqueness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, didn't it give him like a scar in his eyebrow?
Yeah, he had a scar that was never addressed.
Right.
And she didn't know. She wondered if it was from the war. I preferred to just think, you know, he slipped on something in the kitchen.
Those crabs got out of hand.
Fell on an egg beater, you know. Oh, yeah, baby, it was the krauts.
Well, and Allie is equally vague. Allie is equally, you know, cut from some sort of amorphous feminine mold. You know, like we were talking about before the podcast, you know, I was copying down things and started laughing because the description of her body was so vague and useless. And I quote, Allie's body was firm and well proportioned, breasts softly rounded, stomach flat, legs slim. Now, admittedly, stomach flat tells you something. But, you know, flat's pretty relative. And legs slim, again, a relative measure, but it might tell you something. But breasts are pretty typically softly rounded.
Yeah.
And saying that someone is firm and well-proportioned, that's all dependent on what you consider firm and well-proportioned. It just strikes me as basically this is like the skeleton of a love story.
Hmm.
And what Nicholas Sparks wants you to do is read this book and go, oh man, this reminds me of somebody else.
Yeah.
Like, it's basically a platform for romantic fantasy, which I guess makes it a romance novel. I don't know why I'm criticizing it for that, but...
Well, yeah, it's just strange because it seemed like a lot more attention was paid to describing Noah's impressive physique. I don't know why the same attention wasn't paid to Allie.
Yeah, that was weird, man, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's... But, you know, neither here nor there. I'll read you another example of the lack of specificity that greatly amused me. So this is about Lon. Right?
Mm.
And Lon, of course, is the wolf
square.
Man.
Yeah.
He is the attorney, the square, who Allie is set up to marry. He knew he would win the case because he mastered the law and charmed the jury. He always did, and losses were infrequent now. Part of it came from being able to select the cases he had the expertise to win. He had reached that level in his practice. Only a select few in the city had that kind of stature, and his earnings reflected that. How is that not intended to be funny? How is that?
It's almost like a Donald Barthelme thing.
Yeah. You know? Well, you know, I thought about that a few times, actually. I remember in The Dead Father, there's a great section... Where, you know, of course, Barthelme, one of the experimental writers of the 70s, sort of deconstructing the form. And there's one part where, instead of going into, you know, opening a chapter by lovingly describing the scenery, he just says, you know, a field.
Yeah.
Grass, trees,
rock.
Bugs.
Yeah.
just the laziest possible, just, yeah, you know what I'm getting at, all right, you fill in the rest. And this book feels like that so many times.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing that is bothersome about this book, is that Nicholas Sparks, whatever he may be as a man or an individual, mm-hmm. is bored writing. He is bored making books in a skillful way. And the thing that my attention would have been drawn to is like, all right, well, you know, who is this old Lon Schmo? You know, I have to make him kind of unsympathetic. But then again, you have to believe that this woman who is the heroine could fall in love with him. You know, because, I mean, to a certain extent, who you fall in love with does say something about you. So you have to make it believable that the best woman in the world, according to the book, could fall in love with the most boring man in the planet. Yeah. And he doesn't really have discernible good qualities except being kind of a security blanket.
Yeah.
Which implies that Allie has no will of her own and is extremely insecure, and that much as in a confusing time right before her marriage when she's filled with stress, she has reached out to Noah. Sure enough, at some point, she will run off from Noah because she's ambivalent and confused again.
Well, and, I mean, I think Allie came off the worst in this book. Just all kinds of, you know, there are little things, for example, when she's just, going back a second actually, just the very fact that this guy has been just tormented for 14 years.
Yeah.
And she just shows up back in his life just to tell him, oh yeah, now that you've almost forgotten about me, I'm engaged. I just wanted to drive many miles to just drive a stake through your heart, you son of a bitch. And then when she's describing Lon, she says at one point, you know, he's a good man, Noah. You'd really like him. Which, I know every time I've heard a sentence similar to that, just, you know, nope. He could be me with a goatee, you know, that son of a bitch.
Well, you know, you want people to be happy, but I mean, you're never going to be friends with him.
No.
You know? I mean, come on now.
You want them to be happy far away so that you can pretend they never existed. It's just, it's very easy. Maybe I got a little too real for Nicholas Sparks there.
Drifting away to one of my personal bete noir, there's a lot in this book about poetry. And one of the reasons why Allie is supposed to fall in love with this guy is because he loves poetry. Which should mean that Allie is the easiest female mark on the planet. That if a guy walks into a party and is like, hey, man, you ever heard Puff the Magic Dragon? No, but I'd like to have sex with you. I mean, you know, she, oh my God, there's a guitar and this guy likes poetry. Cool. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot about poetry. There's a lot about the poet's soul and what it means to be a poet and all these other things. In particular, Ben, I'll read you a little slice of Nicholas Sparks' wisdom about writing. Poetry wasn't written to be analyzed.
No.
It was meant to inspire without reason, to touch without understanding. To touch without understanding, that's I think that's in the legal code underneath sexual assault.
Well, we all know, Greg, that a poem is a shit that your heart takes. And no, well, that was all the poetry stuff. I like to, Sparks occasionally name drops, you know, the poets that Noah loves to read to Allie, including, to my surprise, Robert Browning. Hey, baby, bring me a chunk of lapis lazuli big as a Jew's head cut off at the nape. I don't see that one working out so well. But yeah, that's all. In the every poem snippet that is quoted in here is taken so far out of context as to be rendered meaningless.
Yeah.
And just sounds like a bland platitude of some kind.
Right. Well, that's the frustrating thing. And, I mean, you know, he says, he lists at one point Dylan Thomas, Walt Whitman, Eliot, which I would assume T.S., Shakespeare, and King David of the Psalms. You know, not the psalmist, but King David of the Psalms. Mm-hmm. You know, which kind of brings up a thing that these authors, if you read them cheaply and superficially, again, it is easy to be attracted by the charm of the sound and the rotundity of the oratory. And that's exactly what Eliot is kind of mocking or parodying in things like The Wasteland, where The Wasteland is built out of sort of scraps in a neurasthenic narrator's mind and all that kind of stuff. And the whole point is that, you know, you don't read poetry because it sounds real good. You read poetry because it discerns something. It makes things clearer. Not it offers up a cotton candy cloud of delight. I enjoy poetry a great deal. I like it a lot better than I did once. But I also know that the reason why I like it is because it quickens perception, not because it dulls me like a narcotic.
Well, and the whole, you know, poetry isn't meant to be analyzed. I'm sure as a teacher,
no.
That's something that probably... How many times have you heard variations on that in the classroom? Of, you know, it doesn't really matter like what the author intended. It's just, you know, how it makes me feel. No, it does matter what the author intended. It matters a great deal. That's, in fact, the most important part.
Well, I think that the, you know, the instructiveness of that comment is mainly that it shows how little care someone else is willing to expend on something that you work very hard on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that Whitman even, you know, Whitman in the American tradition is known basically as the slop fest. You know, like, oh, Whitman, that cheese dick, you know, he just put down a bunch of lists and claimed it was poetry. And it's like, no, man, guy worked incessantly. Mm-hmm. He's constantly editing, constantly adjusting, constantly moving things around. And just the cheapness of that idea that, you know, this man, Whitman in particular, who made a ruin of himself in many ways. You know, he's only recognized right at the end of his life in a very, very sad time for him. Mm-hmm. And that we should like it because, you know, oh, well, it makes me feel like being poetic. Well, then you know little of poetry and you know less of being an adult.
Well, you know, I will say that there is one very important thing that both Walt Whitman and Nicholas Sparks have in common.
Being white men?
Yeah, of course. So, Greg, you want to... well, I guess we can skip ahead a bit to get to the framework here.
Yeah.
And address that, because there's a lot of ore in that vein.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, old Lon, he comes into town looking for Allie. He's deeply concerned. It's his law office, you know, he's had to put the law aside, had many cases and legal matters to...
They've been very important.
Yes.
Take Nicholas Sparks' word for it.
Yeah. So he rolls into town, and Allie, you know, there's the tearful goodbye to Noah, and she goes and tells Lon she's breaking it off, and of course she comes back.
Right.
So then, we jump ahead about 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Noah and Allie are in the nursing home.
Right.
And Allie has terrible Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And the notebook is, you know, of course, as Greg mentioned, the story we have read, the third-person portion of the narrative set in 46. That's the contents of the notebook. And Noah reads the notebook to Allie in the nursing home every night, hoping to jog her memory of their past relationship. Because, of course... He's got the Alzheimer's. I'll let you. What any points you want to kick this part off with?
Well, it just occurs to me, you know, that perhaps Noah has matured as a writer. Perhaps Nicholas Sparks is saying that Noah is a really terrible writer, and when he talks in first person, he's much more interesting.
You know. The thought had actually crossed my mind, but I thought, no, that's far too hopeful. I mean, I will say, you know, I genuinely found the first-person portions to be much more interesting and to have damning with faint praise, perhaps, but I thought they were more well-written.
I, on the other hand, found them manipulative and cheap.
I don't think these things are mutually exclusive.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, there is more vividness. And the reason why there is more vividness is because the struggle is intractable. So the thing that divides Allie and Noah in the middle section in 1946 is that she has agreed to get married to this guy. All she has to do is say, I changed my mind, I'm sorry, I'm not marrying him. Easy as that. That's it. That's all it takes. There's not really any pressure. Her mother gives up on pressuring her. And they live the rest of their life apparently without consequence.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing changes.
Yeah.
Except they're in love and happy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the end and the beginning, they are both crippled by old age. Noah in particular has had a stroke and sort of lumbers half able down hallways trying to get to Allie. Allie, as you said, has no memory whatsoever of him. And so there are all these intractable physical dilemmas that there's just no getting around. There's no kiss off you can give to your parents that will recover your memory.
Yes. And that was the thing that really pissed me off with this last portion. I will say there were times I was surprised. Like, wow, you know, this last quarter of the novel, that's, you know, present tense, first person, present right. day, it's actually kind of working, you know? I'm kind of digging it.
Right.
And then the first blow to that was it's revealed that at times, you know, because Noah reads the story to her every day, that some days she sort of swims up out of the Alzheimer's
right.
and she remembers him.
Right.
And she, you know, remembers everything and, you know, it's great. And the doctors are just baffled because they're trying to apply their doctor science. and they say that that's impossible because she has a degenerative brain disease. But what the nurses know that the doctors don't, and they tell Noah, is that it's because of the power of love.
Right.
Now, let me tell you why that pisses me off. And surprisingly, perhaps, it's not because, you know, I'm a fan of science and rationality over, you know, emotion. But because if you were reading this book and you have a loved one who is actually dying of Alzheimer's,
yeah.
What a terrible fucking thing to say to you that, oh, well, the reason that you your loved one doesn't remember you is because either you don't love them enough or they don't love you enough.
Right.
And if you just tried a little harder, you could fix it with right. love.
Yeah.
Fuck you. That's yeah. awful.
Well, and there's two things that two immediate objections occur to me. So the Noah describes the initial sort of affliction with Alzheimer's as being the most painful time of his life. And the reason why is because he is filled with facts and memories of their love, and she can't remember any of it. So he's always correcting her and explaining things, and she'll walk in and say, like, oh, well, who the hell are you? Or why are all these people here? Well, they're your children, this is this. And she gets really upset, as Alzheimer's patients frequently do. So it's already been proven that no matter how many times you remind her of things that happened in her former life, she just doesn't remember. That's the problem.
Yes.
And that's kind of a illusion that a lot of laymen have about Alzheimer's and a lot of brain problems,
mm-hmm.
is that, like, the brain is, like, inside the brain, there's, like, a little version of you working levers and shit.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when you get Alzheimer's, it's like something blacked out all the levers. Mm-hmm. So you're, like, still sitting inside this room. You're like, man, I just wish somebody turned the power back on. And that like, that's what somebody's waiting for. That, like, you know, the ego is going to swim back up out of, you know, the ether. And you're going to see her again. I mean, actually, I will use this by virtue of contrast and not to draw any sort of maudlin weepiness into this. But my grandfather had a stroke, pretty crippling stroke. And he did not recognize this. He lost the ability to speak, everything else. Yet he retained a lot of habitual movements. So, like, things that he would do frequently, like check his watch. Mm-hmm. He kept looking at his wrists to look at a watch that wasn't there anymore. And so my dad started reading things to him that he had read over and over again in his youth, you know, and just like beloved books and things like that. And he would show recognition. The reason why he showed recognition was because they were things he had done over and over again in his youth. They were patterns. The whole idea is that you're going to build out of an old pattern into a new one.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, oh, yeah, you know, while you've been sick, I wrote this cool story. Because all it's going to do is make a new connection with this stranger, which isn't what Noah wants. And that's the problem, is that Noah can't accept the reality of the present. And that would have been perhaps more tragic, but I think more true.
Yeah, I mean, and there is, you know, part of the maudlin quality of it is, you know, why would anyone do this to themselves?
Right.
Or to a loved one,
right.
You know? Once things reach this point, you know, it doesn't make any difference to her if you don't keep hanging around, you know, all the time and constantly pestering her. She doesn't know who you are in the first place.
Right.
So why do you put the both of you through this torture?
Well, I mean, I can see saying like, all right, well, you don't remember me. But to a certain extent, some semblance of your personality is there. Because I've always cared about you. I will come around. I'll talk to you. And I'll keep you company. But why would you spend all this time trying to say, like, well, basically, you know, you're not good enough as you are right now.
Yeah.
So I'm going to hector you with this fairy tale story. Mm-hmm. And actually, this brought to mind a quote that Noah uttered sententiously at Allie while they were still in their wooing phase. So, you know, Allie's showed up at this house and, you know, gotten rained on, had lots of chest-rubbing sex with Noah. And basically, Allie's objection to marrying Noah is that, well, you know, my mom will be upset. My mom and my dad don't like you, Noah. I'm a grown woman, but somehow I can't manage these two things. And Noah says, you can't live your life for other people. Even though that is their mutual definition of love thereafter. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the bigger contradictions of the book is that, you know, there is this sort of romantic quest for self-fulfillment of, you know, well, Noah wanders off into the freaking wilderness and restores a plantation house by himself just so he can be at peace with himself. And Allie has to wander off away from all her commitments just to find out who Allie really is. And yet, the rest of their lives are devoted not to finding out who they are, but to mutual self-sacrifice. And I think there's something to that, but the book never really plays with that contradiction.
Well, that's not happy at all, is it, really? Well, the thing I think we have to address now,
yeah,
is the weird old ending to this book.
Yes. Yes.
Which has caught me like a hammer to the temple, I'll tell you that. I didn't see it going in this direction.
It's the Sparks money shot, man. That's what they call it.
So, at the end of the book, the last, like, few pages, Noah is loping down the hallway in the dead of night to Allie's room at the nursing home.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's their anniversary. It's their 49th anniversary. And he has to, you know, talk to a nurse at the nurse's station, and the nurse sort of kindly lets him go. And it's actually, you know, kind of a sweet scene. And,
yeah, the nurse scene was good.
Yeah. And because, you know, the nurse basically says, you know, oh, I can't let you go into the room, but I can go get a cup of coffee. Don't do anything dumb. You know, that's sweet. You
right,
know?
Right.
And so he, you know, he goes down to the room. I mean, half his body is paralyzed from a stroke. It's hard going. It's, I mean, I know you're cackling hysterically, Greg, but it's...
No, I just thought of something different.
Oh,
go on.
Something different. Okay. Yeah, it's hard going. He, you know, with last little strength, he opens the door and he goes in and he sees Allie. And he opens up the window and the moonlight falls on her, and he had said earlier something about how he had wanted to kiss her. You know, he didn't know if he had already kissed her for the last time.
Right.
Which is always, you know, I think, even without dementia, that's often a concern that enters a relationship. You know?
Yeah.
It's all very sweet. And he decides to take a risk, and he leans out to kiss his Alzheimer's-y wife. And this is the last paragraph of the book. "And when her lips meet mine, I feel a strange tingling I have never felt before in all our years together, and I do not pull back. And suddenly a miracle, for I feel her mouth open, and I discover a forgotten paradise, unchanged all this time, ageless like the stars. I feel the warmth of her body, and as our tongues meet, I allow myself to slip away, as I had so many years ago. I close my eyes and become a mighty ship in churning waters, strong and fearless, and she is my sails. I gently trace the outline of her cheek, then take her hand in mine. I kiss her lips, her cheeks, and listen as she takes a breath. She murmurs softly, 'Oh, Noah, I've missed you. Another miracle, the greatest of all. And there's no way I can stop the tears as we begin to slip toward heaven itself.' For at that moment, the world is full of wonder as I feel her fingers reach for the buttons on my shirt, and slowly, ever so slowly, she begins to undo them one by one." That's got to be against the law, man. I don't know. That...
A lot of slipping in that passage. Yeah, well, I mean, two things we probably should establish. For one thing, one of the things that keeps happening is that, like, he'll hang out with her, and she will remember who he is for maybe an hour. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, she's just like, holy shit, who the hell are you?
Yeah.
So, it is taking a tremendous risk to have sex with a woman who might at any moment think that she has woken up and believe that you are raping her. Mm-hmm. Do you really want your wife to experience you raping her?
Yeah.
Secondly, the thing that wasn't really addressed, and I know this is cruel, and I know this is terrible, but goddammit, it's schlock. These aren't real people.
Yeah.
The man has had a stroke that's paralyzed half of his body. Yeah. How? Yeah. How's this good?
Yeah. Yeah. That, well, I mean, there is a certain mechanical difficulties that surely enter this equation. I mean, I have heard that this sort of thing happens very frequently in nursing homes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nursing home romances are pretty... Mm-hmm. They're not proverbial, but, I mean, yeah. People have heard of them. They exist. Yeah. Good on them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's just, you know... I don't even know what to say to it, quite frankly. I mean, that's just the weirdest damn ending possible for this book. I mean, the capstone of the book is, you know, we're going to have sex with my wife with dementia, you know. It's, oh, how sweet. I see why all the teenage girls love this humdinger. I don't know, man.
The thing that I kept sort of coming back to over and over again, very, very early on, the word odyssey is used. And I remember reading a long time ago, somewhere, I can't remember, a critic saying that, you know, the romantic generation, so Byron and Keats and all those people, were always trying to rewrite Paradise Lost. Always imaginatively seeing the world through Paradise Lost. Whereas the modern authors, i.e. after the 20th century, have always tended to try to rewrite the Odyssey. And, you know, there's a sense in which this wandering man who is washed up on the shores of various waitresses and floozies all the time thinking of his one true love, and, you know, he's always going after his Penelope, his Allie, is touching and heartfelt, and, you know, the wandering love, the love that is constant no matter how much it strays and all that kind of stuff. But... It's too domesticated for all that. Like, it doesn't have any sense of, like, wildness or struggle or weirdness. And then the last touching note, stranger sex. It's just, it's weird. It's this weird, like, burst of depravity out of what has been a very, very tame and conventional book.
Yeah.
And I know that what you're supposed to think is that this is, like, the magic wand that he will wave over her. And that... yeah.
That's what he calls it, anyway.
She will henceforth be restored to Alliedom. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, why would you think that?
Yeah. If you believe in magic, and I hope you do. Well, Greg, would you recommend this book?
I can't see why. Yeah. I mean, there are so many books that are better about aging. In fact, there's actually kind of a hue and outcry a few years ago because the book about aging sex was becoming ubiquitous. Now, admittedly, usually what that was the aging male professor having sex with students or having sex with, like, a younger woman, like, oh, oi, I'm so foible. And I meant to say feeble, but we're going to stick with foible. I think it's more poetic. But, you know, like, I'm so feeble, I'm so infirm, and she's so firm and hot and all that stuff, and but yet I'm touched by love and all that sort of stuff. And there are even better stories about Alzheimer's, and there are even better stories about love and questing love and all that kind of stuff. There's actually a pretty good movie about a guy whose wife, I think, has dementia or Alzheimer's, and you know, she falls in love with another man. Like, oh,
I believe, wasn't that a movie by Sarah Polley? My One True Love.
Oh, man. Guess, folks, when Ben has Alzheimer's, all I have to do is mention the filmography of Sarah Polley.
Snap too, man.
Like Dracula out of his coffin. It's alive. It's alive. It might have been.
Yeah.
I couldn't say.
I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure. Q17 emails. Fucking idiot. Well, is there any particular thing you would, any book you would recommend instead?
Any of the books he mentions would be better. you know, actually, I will recommend one that is mentioned offhandedly, but is not engaged in any meaningful way. And that is Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking, which is a poem by Walt Whitman. And it is the... It is a poem that it took me a long time to understand, but is one of the more moving poems I've ever read. And it's about, it's basically, it, you know, it's like all Whitman poems. It sort of presumes a Whitman persona doing stuff. Young boy goes down to the shore, and his one delight is to go out to the Atlantic Ocean and spend time among the dunes and look at the moon and all this stuff. And he falls in love with these two songbirds that are sort of singing to each other. And the poem is about how the one songbird dies, but the other songbird keeps, like, hanging out and singing and, like, flying around looking all sad and stuff. And I know it sounds like, you know, well, Greg, Jesus Christ, you thought The Notebook was maudlin? Great recommendation. But there are really, really, really great lines in it. And, you know, as Whitman is laying there looking out at the ocean, you know, the waves are sort of unrolling this revelation to him that the great secret of life is love and death, and that the two will always be tumbling together. And it's very, very moving and very beautiful. And I would say just read that poem. You'll save some time, and you'll have a pretty good poem reading.
Huh. Well, you know, I wouldn't recommend this book either. I think I was going to go a very different direction with this, largely because I had totally forgotten before we started recording that I needed to think up what I was going to recommend. I mean, as long as we're in the poem mood, I might as well recommend some Charles Bukowski.
How
about some unflinching take on romance? How about Love is a Dog from Hell?
Yeah.
Or Last Night of the Earth poems. Just skip to Bluebird, the most touching poem that I perhaps have ever read.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite poem. So
well,
that's not precisely true, but very touching. Take a page from old Sparks and recommend you some poetry.
Yeah,
and then we'll read it to you real slow under an old oak tree, either in the mountains or possibly at the coast.
We'll serve you crab.
Yeah,
we'll rub chests all over you. It'll be nearly erotic.
There's the slogan we've been looking for.
Nearly erotic.
Cannon fodder. Look great on a t-shirt. All right, well, Greg, what's the next book we're reading, man? It's your time to...
Well, you know, one of the first books we did, in fact, the first book we did was Twilight.
Oh.
And I don't know if you folks have seen this, but the lead couple in the Twilight saga, Rob Patterson and Kristen Schmiede, two people.
It's Romanian, right?
Yeah. The Armenian child star sensations of the early 2000s. They were dating for a while. Yeah. Now they're breaking up. Now, you know what else Rob Pattinson was in?
What's that?
The film adaptation of Water for Elephants.
Oh.
So, you know, I think it's time for some Water for Elephants. I think it's a nice segue. It's another thwarted love story, I understand, from the previews of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It also apparently has to do with circuses, which, yeah, you know, always a plus.
Carny love.
So, yeah, that's my pick.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I should say, while I'm at it, last week's Cannon Fodder episode was the first one that I received personal email criticizing me over.
Oh, really?
Yes, I didn't even told you this, because I was so embarrassed by it.
Oh, no.
So, yes, folks, in fact, I do know how to say Fibonacci. In the weird mood of Bieber fever hysterics that took us over when we were doing that podcast, I inserted an additional I after the B and said Fibonacci. So, yes, I know how to say Fibonacci. Never you fear.
How... It's been a little while since I put it together, but where in God's name did you find the opportunity?
First step to forever, remember? You know, first, one, two,
oh,
the number,
okay.
Four.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that's right. That's
yeah,
right.
My numerological thesis on Bieber, which is forthcoming.
Yes.
Hold your breath. And furthermore, I'm aware that when I pointed out the discrepancy between Jesus and Fergie, that the central mystery, well, one of the central mysteries of the Christian religion, is that Jesus could spend so much time with Mary Magdalene, who was herself far worse off than old Fergie time. Yes, I know, the first of the least and all that kind of stuff. Just never mind, people. Just never mind.
As long as we're confessing various errors we've made, dear friend Bentley Alderman informed me shortly after the... Actually, I think it was Austin both. I think it was the brothers Alderman.
The brothers, the collective.
Bentley and Austin.
Attorneys at law.
Informed me that Vox by...
Nicholson Baker.
Nicholson Baker.
Phew.
Close call. Was not about... Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, but in fact a book that either she gave him or he gave her.
Hmm. Well, he gave her Leaves of Grass.
Oh,
which
yeah. So
ties
she,
into the Notebook.
Yeah, so yeah, she probably gave him Vox. I probably should have written that shit down when they told me. Anyway, the important thing is I fucked up. So, with our various apologies out of the way.
Yeah. Time to close it up, I guess.
Yeah, want to thank you very much for listening. And
yes.
Seriously, please email us,
yeah,
cannonfodderpod@gmail.com. Please, you know, send us some book suggestions. We're starting to, you know, getting down to the dregs of the old list. We need some suggestions, because God help us, we might be doing a book by Snooki soon.
Yeah.
And I'd like to avoid that... that bullet in the cylinder slowly rotating.
Yeah, sure, surely you have an annoying friend who reads terrible things. Come on,
yeah,
now, people.
Yeah.
Just send us stuff, send us thoughts, anything you want to say. Just ask us how we're doing.
Yeah.
We like that, too.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, please do that. You can follow me on Twitter, at
mm-hmm.
Ben R. Williams. You can follow Greg occasionally, at Old Jawbone.
Yeah.
Go
yeah.
to my website, benrwilliams.com.
Yeah.
And, as always, special thanks to our old buddy, Mr. Ryan Browning, for the use of his song Destroyer that bookends the podcast, and you can download that song and plenty of other great songs from SewnTogetherRecords.com.
Yeah, and actually, one thing we should mention to a very, very faithful supporter of our podcast, big congratulations to old Jeff Huber.
Yes.
Who is celebrating an engagement. So big ups, Jeff.
Congratulations, man.
Nice doings.
I've been saying for years that you had it in you, in spite of the fact that we've never met and I only learned about your existence quite recently. Good on you, man. I'll look forward to shaking your hand when I finally get to meet you in person.
In the nursing home. When I'm reading you my love story.
slowly unbuttoning your shirt.
And with that, folks,
this has been the last episode of Cannon Fodder. Good night.
Good night.